I want to continue this morning thinking with you about the Great Commission. And I'm not thinking of it as a special gift or calling, although that certainly is involved. Directing what I believe is one of the finest and the largest school of world mission and evangelism in the world, I spend most of my time with people that feel a special call to be a missionary or an evangelist. But if that's the way we have to interpret the Great Commission, it's going to leave most of us out. I'm thinking of this not as a call as much as a lifestyle. And I can see my mother fulfilling it. My kids are Marietta, as well as myself. And until we can get it down to where all of us recognize the challenge of making disciples, I don't think we have yet entered into the intent of this last command of Christ. For after affirming that to him belonged all authority in heaven and on earth, after declaring that he was clearly Lord of all, he went on then to say what that means by way of its implication. For if the whole world should come to know him and worship him. So those who have come to know him as Lord are sent forth to make disciples. And to that end we go. To that end we baptize. To that end we teach. But the objective is to disciple the world. And it will come through learning of Christ. This is the basic meaning of disciple. And as we learn of him, we will grow in his likeness. And invariably, we will become involved in his mission. And so looking at Jesus, we see the interpretation of the command. We noticed yesterday the principle of incarnation when he became a servant. And he immediately brought before us the basic role that all disciples have in this world. Whether you happen to be a teacher or evangelist or homemaker, your basic role is that of servant, just as it was with Jesus. And because this is recognized, you will have an opportunity to disciple. Until people know you as a servant, you haven't earned the right to be heard. You haven't established credibility for anything that you say. But by virtue of your servanthood, there are going to be people that will want to know more about you. You have created a mystery. You have been so unlike the world. And so that underscores that second principle of selection. While you continue to serve and minister to people, you're especially alert to some that God seems especially to draw into your life. Very likely there are people already close to you. You live with them, or close to them. Or they may have a certain interest that is very similar to yours. Maybe they just like to play racquetball, or they are interested in your kind of music. But there'll be some very natural ways that God brings some into the orbit of your influence. And especially you want to respond to those whose hearts seem to be yearning to know more about your Lord. In a sense, then, you are simply responding to what God is doing in answer to your prayers. And this process of selection then leads to a third principle that I would call association. For God creates an environment now for learning. Stay together. He illustrates this in the family. In his providence, he has seen to it that no one gets into the world unless they have already two people working for them. And very likely, you're immediately introduced to some brothers and sisters. And this is the context in which most of our values are learned. Now, you may not agree with everything taught in modern psychology, but I think you will agree at a fundamental premise that is foundational to all the behavioral studies. And that is that your values are largely learned in the first years of your life. Now, they may later be changed, but only with great effort. And that's why, to a great degree, all of us still reflect, even now, the values that we learned when we were just babies. The greatest education that anyone ever receives comes long before they get into a public school. And yet, during this time, there were no curriculums that were printed for you. There were no classrooms. There were no bells ringing. And when it was over, you didn't get a diploma. But it's the greatest education any person in this world ever receives. This is what Jesus is doing. He's establishing a home environment by bringing these disciples around him. They walk those trails together. They work together. Seldom is Jesus seen doing anything without the disciples being with him. And in the evening, when they are weary, they turn into some friendly home and eat together. And then, I suppose, for lack of accommodations, they just lie down on the floor and sleep together. He came to save the world. And finally, he dies to bring redemption to mankind. But he spends more time with a handful of disciples than with everybody in the world put together. That's not an accident. He is ordaining a way that every person who believes on him can identify with. Now, as he ministers, the group of disciples grows. Soon we read of 70, and then 120, and ultimately about 500 believers before Jesus returns to heaven. And this is, of course, a group that is difficult to manage in close association. And so about a year or two into his training, we read how Jesus, from the larger group, chose 12 to be with him. Then he ordained them to preach and to teach and cast out demons. You'll notice they were first ordained to be with him. That is the qualification for the more specialized forms of ministry to which they are called. Even out of the 12, there was Peter, James, and John, which had some privileges the others did not enjoy, which underscores a principle. The smaller the size of the group being taught, the greater the opportunity to concentrate the lesson. Here is the principle of his follow-up. When you believe on Christ, you become a part of a family, and you are related to all the other members of the faith. In fact, he calls them his children. He speaks of them as brothers and sisters in the kingdom. They are taught to think of God as the Father in heaven. This is the language by which we live. And here you see what emerges to be the church, which is simply the fellowship of believers. It is the company of all those who are committed to Christ. It has tremendous implications for all of us who are being discipled. For those that he brings into our life who want to learn must be brought closely to us. You can't do this with everyone, but with those few especially whose hearts seem to be yearning, there's where you're going to have the greatest challenge of your life. And probably the more casual the relationships that you have, the better. I like this. I appreciate times when we have structured meetings like this, but even on this cruise, I suspect the more enduring things that will be remembered are the fellowship hours around the table, or walking the promenade deck, or going out together, visiting in the city. Certainly that's the way it is in life. When you just have fellowship around a cup of coffee, or when you drop over for a visit at home, or when you go out and play golf, you're not losing any time. It's just a different way that the time is being invested. But it's all the part of a ministry. My, this puts excitement into it. I'm serving the Lord just as much sitting down and having a meal with somebody as when I preach to them. And it means that there's nothing that's insignificant. And you need to find ways for that casual fellowship. One of the problems that we face in so-called special forms of ministry is that much of our ministry is structured. I know as a professor, I have to work at this idea of getting some time casually with students. And so I have to find ways to have a cup of coffee with them, or invite them over for lunch, or take them out with me on a weekend, as I often do. Because it's in these normal relationships of life that we're going to have our greatest opportunity to disciple. Now, to bring some continuity into it, it's well to have some structured meetings. And I think for this reason, the little Bible study or the prayer group is one of the most effective means by which you can have some close fellowship. I remember after I was converted there at Southwestern University at Georgetown, one of the first things I realized was that I needed some fellowship. And unfortunately, I didn't seem to find it where I was going to church. And I was in a dormitory situation where there wasn't much encouragement. But I knew that there were a few Christians, certainly, on that wing where I lived. And every night, about 10 o'clock, I'd go around that dormitory and I'd knock on the door of the boys and I'd say, "Could you come down for a few minutes and just have some prayer with me in my room?" Or I'd say, "Could I just come in and we can pray together?" I could usually get three or four together. And for more than 2 years until I graduated, every night that I was there, I got some boys together to pray with me. I needed it. You know, I've forgotten most of the things that I've learned at the university, and I'm not sure I'm any worse off for it. But I can still remember some of those times I got the boys together. More than once I broke up a poker game. They got to kind of where they expected it. And when I went off to graduate school, one of the first things I looked for was a prayer meeting. I found one up in the attic, and I joined it, just invited myself. When I went off to pastor and then to become a teacher, didn't find one, so I just started one with some of the professors. And for years, that's been a part of my life. Now with some students, once or twice a week, usually in the morning before breakfast, for more than 25 years, I've had a little group of students in my office. That is something I need, and they need. Doesn't matter really the size of the larger fellowship, you can always break it down into smaller groups. And you'll find this principle at work wherever you see growing churches. I mentioned China the other morning. Did you know they don't have the opportunity often to gather in their large meetings? Most of them don't even have buildings for worship. How do you suppose they sustain this remarkable growth? It's through the discipling in their homes and in their personal relationships day by day. That's the power of the church. Grady mentioned speaking in this large church in Seoul, Korea. I understand that just a few months ago they passed the 500,000 mark of their membership. And it's an exciting experience to be there and preach to that group. 30,000 crowded into this building. You go through it 7 times every Sunday. And I remember when I was there talking to Dr. Cho before the service. And he was sharing with me about the 20,000 little groups that they have all over the city. They meet every week, usually on a Thursday or Friday night. I just couldn't help but to think back to the way that Jesus was training his disciples. That's the genius of the church. It's a principle built into the structure of the universe that if you want to learn, you've got to be with your teacher. And the more the opportunity to relate on a personal level, the greater the opportunity to learn. So stay with that little group that God is bringing into your life. That underscores a fourth principle that I would call demonstration. Show them what it means to serve. And because you are together, they have the opportunity to see it. And isn't the illustration always more effective than just the declaration? Wouldn't you appreciate it more if you could actually see demonstrated what I'm talking about than just hearing it? That's one of the limitations you see in this lecture approach. That's something that I've struggled with all these years in a theological school. How do we get the theory into practice? And with a few, I've seen how it can be done, and we're trying to multiply that effort now. In fact, Billy's got a vision for this. He's helping getting some of these sharp young men into the school where they can get some practical training, but also assist me now in giving some of this training to others. That's what we need. We need to multiply those who will spend time with others. We've got a program going right now at Trinity where we have 225 freshmen in the college across the street, and we have 125 disciplers or trainers from the seminary that are working with them. So every freshman for a whole semester will have someone spend an hour a week with them on a one-on-one or a one-on-two relationship. We're working at it. And these guys that he sent up are the ringleaders. They're the coordinators of it. In fact, I'm on sabbatical. I'm not even supposed to be on campus. But I do go up and meet a couple of hours a week with them just to have some fellowship. Also, find time to play some racquetball with some of these boys. You know, Brad is quite a racquetball player. Have you ever played him? But you've got to demonstrate it. That's the way you learn. When you see it, this is what Jesus is doing with these disciples when they're together. Everything he does is an object lesson. We've been thinking about evangelism. We have the account again and again of Jesus with the disciples meeting someone along the trail and talking to them. I was thinking the other night of the day they went into Jericho and he saw Zacchaeus up there in the tree. You know, he was alert. I wonder how many people I've missed, because usually I don't ever look up in the trees. But anybody that's gazing intently upon you from a tree probably indicates there's something working on them. So he stopped and he said, "Why, Zacchaeus, there you are. Come on down.
Because today I want to stay in your house. Can you imagine how Zacchaeus felt?
And if he realized that Jesus called him by his name and he said, I believe Jesus knows me. That's a beautiful realization, isn't it? To realize here's somebody that already knows something about you. One of the things that we need to do in evangelism is to try to find out everything we can about people that we're trying to reach. That's the whole purpose of this school of world missions and evangelism. Especially when we cross cultural barriers. We're spending a lot of time trying to learn how other people think so that we can communicate the gospel. And when someone begins to talk your language and begins to indicate they know something about your situation, you listen to them, don't you? Zacchaeus thought, he not only knows me, but he's inviting himself home with me. Well, I believe that Jesus wants me. Isn't that a beautiful realization? In spite of what he knows about you, he still wants to be with you. Isn't that what makes home precious? When you go home and close the door, you shut out a world that doesn't care. You found that out, don't you? This world's not interested in you. Oh, they like your money, they like your influence, but they don't care anything for your soul. But isn't it wonderful to go back home, close the door, and to see a chair that's reserved for you at the table, just for you. You're somebody. No matter how you've been kicked around in this world, you're wanted there. You're a member of the family. There's no place like home. Do you see Zacchaeus up in that tree? Those leaves beginning to quiver, and it's not just the gentle breeze that's blowing through the street. Come on, if you had been in his place, how would you have felt? And you'd look down into the face of the Son of God, and you knew he was talking to you, and he was thinking to himself, he not only knows me and wants me, but he's not ashamed for everybody in town to know that he's my friend. I believe that Jesus loves me. You remember when that message got through to you? Maybe it was in a crisis moment, like in a revival meeting, or maybe it was a long process of influences in your home or your Sunday school, but the day came when it dawned upon you that you were loved and that Jesus died for you and rose from the grave. I'll tell you, when that message comes through, you're going to get down out of that tree. Maybe that's the problem. People haven't yet realized that they're loved. Not like Jesus loves them. Some way we've got to get the message through. I'm glad that when Zacchaeus realized it, he didn't waste any time. He made haste and he came down on that old street corner and he made his peace with God. Oh, I expect there were people there in the crowd that began to snicker. They never thought they'd see that happen to Zacchaeus, the biggest sinner in town. But do you think it mattered to him what the unbelieving crowd was saying when he knew in his heart he had found the Savior? His sins were gone, and he could feel the gentle hand of Jesus lifting him up. And he knew he was made a new creature. And here were these disciples, flabbergasted, looking on. They had never seen it on this manner before. And they followed along as Jesus went on home with Zacchaeus. There were still a lot of things that had to be straightened out. One of them was this matter of restitution. He had some things to make right. Thank God you don't have to know it all when you come to Jesus. You can find out some things later, but just respond to the light that you have. And Jesus told Zacchaeus that he had come to seek and to save the lost. Zacchaeus needed to hear that, but these disciples also needed to hear it, because this was a demonstration of what his life was all about.
And you can see this all the way through the Gospels. His times of prayer, his compassion for the social needs of people, his stewardship of time. Everything about his life is a demonstration of what it means to be a child of God. And those disciples were learning. Is that the way those with you are learning? Do they see it? When they're together with you in your family devotions every day. What a beautiful way to teach children some of the elements of worship just around your dinner table, or maybe it's around the bed before you go to sleep, or whenever it is, but worship is a part of your family schedule. And sometimes the friends come over and they begin to observe how you spend some time with the neighbor or with some of the people at the office, and they begin to catch on how you're using your time in your home. It's a demonstration. Pastor, if you can help it, don't ever make a call alone. There are emergencies that come up and you'll have to respond immediately, but if possible, take a man or a woman with you, maybe a couple of them. Let them see. Because there's nothing that you're doing that they probably couldn't do just as well or maybe better if you just show them how. Encourage them. Let them get the thrill of the ministry. It's a principle of demonstration. And all the while, of course, they're learning what it means to disciple. Could that be the problem that we're facing in the church? We're telling people to go out and win the world. But I wonder if they've seen a demonstration of the Great Commission at the level where they live every day. But that brings me to underscore this next principle, fifth, that I would call delegation. For when people know what they can do, involve them. Get them started. Give them something that is suited to their ability and to their temperament and to their gifts. This is what Jesus was doing. At first, they didn't know a great deal. But at least they could provide some entertainment and some hospitality. Providentially, Jesus didn't have a parsonage provided by the church, so he just lived with his people. That's a beautiful way to get people involved. You know, when I started out preaching for 2 years, I didn't have a parsonage. Well, they had one, but when they learned they got a single preacher, some of these shrewd businessmen got together and rented it out. They learned they could pay about a third of my salary by just renting the parsonage. But it was a beautiful experience because it was also understood I'd just have to live with them on the weekend when I came up. And I don't know of a house within 5 miles of those three little country churches that I wasn't welcome. I'd always manage to get there at least by supper time. You know, I haven't found any place in the Gospels where Jesus turned down an invitation to dinner. I was glad when I discovered that. That's one place in the Day of Judgment I don't think I'm going to be guilty. But Jesus was getting these people involved. They furnished his entertainment. We read after his first trip to Jerusalem, he was going back and he was preaching. That requires, I think, a little study. But the disciples, he said, or it's recorded, were baptizing. There's no record in the gospel that the disciple, that Jesus himself ever baptized anybody. He turned that over to his men. And when I read that, I couldn't help but smile, because when I started out, they gave me these little churches out in the country, but I hadn't finished seminary. I hadn't gone through the course of study. I wasn't ordained. When you really get hard up, I guess they'll use almost anything. But I found out to just go out and love the people and do the best you can, they'll put up with almost anything. And it wasn't long before some of them were getting saved. And they wanted to be baptized. And so I said, well, we'll have a great big service. We're going to have it on a Sunday afternoon. Invite everybody in the country. But I made a mistake because the word got out to my district superintendent. And he informed me of something I didn't even know. Some of the fine print. Since I wasn't ordained, I wasn't qualified to minister the sacraments. And I remember when he called me up one day and he kind of apologized, but then very firmly told me I couldn't do it. And you know how it ended up? I had to go in and get the pastor of the big first church in town to come out and baptize my converts, all 25 of them. That was one third of my congregation. Now, that's why I couldn't help but smile when I noticed Jesus had his disciples baptizing long before he had them preaching. That doesn't require a whole lot of theological training to know how to baptize somebody, but at least it's a way of getting started, isn't it? Well, what are you doing? Or more to the point, what are those doing that are following you around? Have you found ways for them to get involved where they already have some natural gifts? Where they feel like they can have a part in the ministry? After a while, Jesus began to send them out. They were probably scared to death the first day. He said, now don't worry, I'll team you up. You can encourage one another. And when you go out, I'm going to ask you to do what you've been watching me do. You just heal the sick, you cast out demons, and you preach the gospel of the kingdom. When you come into town, the first thing to do is to look for the most worthy family and there abide. You see something in this? Presumably it means a home where there's enough sensitivity to your mission. At least they'll open their doors and provide some hospitality. But suppose there's nobody that's the least bit interested. Even after you've made a canvas of the whole community and there's no one that even cares enough to invite you in, what are you going to do? Are you going to grit your teeth and say, I'll make this program work if it kills me? I think some of us are trying to do it. And if we were going to live 1,000 years, maybe we would have that luxury. But you see, we're living under a mandate of the harvest. There are still some villages out there that have never heard the opportunity once. And I said, don't just keep going in circles. You shake the dust off your feet. Go on to the next town. For there may be some people that are hungering and thirsting to know the gospel. You know, that has some implications I don't know if I've ever thought through. I wonder if we applied that to some of these churches that don't care anything about evangelism, how many of them deserve to keep their doors open. But he's not telling them anything new. He is simply enunciating a principle that he's already demonstrated. Isn't this the way he started out? By calling out some of those who wanted to learn and getting with them. Showing them how to live. He's simply now telling them to do what they've already seen. And until they see it, it's really not much use just to tell them to do it. At the end of the way, of course, he gave them the commission to go and disciple. They could understand it because they had been discipled. The implications of this are profound for our lives. For those that are learning with us, we need to find ways in which they can plug in, where they can be involved according to their gifts and their temperaments. I think of a sign out in West Texas that announces a riding academy where they say they have a horse to suit everyone's taste. For fat people, they have fat horses. For skinny people, they have skinny horses. For fast people, they have fast horses. For slow people, they have slow horses. For people that don't know how to ride at all, they've got horses that have never been ridden before. Now, I don't know what your taste is, but there's a horse you can ride. There's a horse all of us can ride, and we need to find the ways that everybody has the opportunity. And then get them started. Probably the first duties will be areas where they've developed already their expertise. But gradually as they learn more, they'll soon get started into maybe a little Bible study, be able to teach it. Or they can have a little prayer group in their home, or they might become a Sunday school teacher. And you're going to discover that some of these people are going to have an aptitude in ways which are far beyond your own. Out of this, you're going to recognize some have a sense of mission as a pastor or as a missionary. And these special forms of calling, they'll come forth. But all of us need to be involved. In one way, almost anyone can get started is in the follow-up of a new believer. All you have to do to be a leader is just one step ahead of the follower. So if you've been saved, at least you can relate to a brand new convert, can't you? And you can share with them where you are and how you pray and how you read the Bible. And you can begin to encourage them in your love for the church. At least at that level, everyone can at least have a part of the ministry. And this just grows on into a natural lifestyle of discipling. It's a principle of delegation. But I have time just to mention one more. Sixth, the principle of obedience. That is, expect them to follow. So much has been said about this already, I don't think I need to labor the point. But as all the other principles, they're structured together so that you really cannot separate one from another. Obedience is going to be the measure by which you learn. And in fact, unless you have the desire to follow, you really have no teachable spirit. And you're looking for that desire in the beginning when you respond to those whom God is leading into your life for discipling. Jesus doesn't ask these men to recite a creed. He doesn't ask them to come to the altar or to shake his hand. He's more practical. Do you know what he said to them all? Follow me. Come home with me. Do something to express your belief. So obedience becomes the witness of your faith. And as they continue to follow, they continue to learn. There's no foreclosure on progress, thank God. You don't have to be smart to be a disciple, but you've got to be obedient. Because if we don't follow, we don't learn. And if you're not learning, you're not a disciple. And I suspect that this process is going to continue right on into heaven. There's never going to be a point when we don't learn something more about the infinite riches of His grace. That's what's going to make the hallelujahs continue to accelerate in their glory all throughout eternity. There's more to know of Him who is infinite in His holiness, in His love. But we've got to learn the lesson here now, to follow. About midway during their training, they came to Caesarea Philippi. It was right there in the place where Herod had his summer palace. This symbol of the power of Rome, and there in the shadow, probably of that palace, Jesus asked the disciples what people were saying about Him. And they said, well, people think you're a prophet. He said, what's your opinion? And that was the time when Peter affirmed, thou art the Christ, the Son of the living God. That was a high moment. They knew clearly who He was. But we're told in Matthew, Mark, and Luke, now Jesus began to explain to the disciples more about His decease. And He mentioned that not many days hence He'd be going down to Jerusalem
And there he would be rejected of the chief priests and the scribes, and he would be killed. But the third day he would rise again. Hallelujah. Have you noticed that when he speaks of the cross, it's usually in the context of the resurrection. Don't ever miss it. There's something on the other side of Calvary that makes Calvary so glorious. And you would have thought those disciples would have been jumping up and down with joy. But if a photographer had been there that day, I think their faces would have been as long as mop handles. Or someone down in Texas would say, a face so long they could suck marbles out of a gopher's hole. Because when they started to follow Jesus, really, that's not what they had in mind. They weren't thinking of the cross. They were still thinking about what it was going to mean to them. The joy, the peace, sitting on the right hand or the left hand of the throne. And Peter, the man who just a moment before had affirmed for the company his faith, he interrupted and said, "Now, Jesus, this can't happen to you. Be this far from me." Can't you sympathize with Peter? He'd already left everything he thought to follow Jesus. But he didn't want his master to talk this way about suffering, about humiliation, about self-denial, about death. And Jesus turned to the big fisherman and he said, "Simon, you are an embarrassment to me. You are an offense because you've been deceived by Satan. You don't savor the things of God, but those that be of men." A free rendering might be, the way you react to this announcement of my death indicates you don't see my mission as God sees it. You're still thinking of what it's going to mean to you in terms of your salvation and your joy and your pleasure. You really haven't seen the heartbeat of God for a lost world yet. Because you don't look at it from the perspective of heaven. You're looking at it still from the perspective of this world. But not just Peter, he says to them all, "I say to you all, any man that comes after me must deny himself." I like the way Philip translates it. Renounce right to yourself and take up your cross and follow me. For if you seek only to save your life, you're going to lose it. But if you will give your life for my sake, you'll find it. He doesn't accuse them of disobedience. He's teaching them only a lesson that is intensified again and again as they move toward Calvary. It's a lesson of the cross. There's where Jesus, in His own blood, is going to seal His obedience. And where His work will be finished. Where the will of God is perfected forever. But there's a cross also for us. That's where we make that choice of total abandon for the will of God, whatever it may be, so that the life we now live is not our own, it's His. And this is at the heart of discipling. There's a cross. Oh, how little we've learned thus far, but if we are committed to that principle, we'll continue to learn. There'll be no end. Some of you are going to have some difficult times. Some of you are going to be led into areas that will be very hard. Some of you are going to have special calls for service. As I mentioned, I direct a school where men and women are in training for missionary service. How they ever got there? Some of them are married, 3 or 4 kids, they show up, they've given up a career. How are they ever going to make it? Well, I've learned this: if God calls you, whatever it is, you can trust Him, He'll see you through. Amen. It's not going to be always easy. The thing that shattered me some years ago, and I think as much as anything, turned my mind toward missions, was when I read about those 5 martyrs that were killed down in Ecuador in South America as they were trying to communicate to the Aka Indians. And the thing
that gripped me was a report of a man who had gone down to interview the wives when it was over. And among other things, he asked the proverbial question, why would God let this happen? After all, your husband was on an errand of mercy. Can you explain why a good God would let your husband be cut down when he was only seeking to help these savages? You're going to be asked that question too, many times in different ways. Why do the righteous suffer? One of those wives turned to that man and said, sir, I would have you to understand, God delivered my husband from the possibility of disobedience. You see, that's what the Christian fears, not death. Jesus has defeated that enemy. The grave has lost its sting. But isn't there a holy fear of disobedience? Because that can swerve us from the fellowship that we know with Him as we walk in the narrow way. One of our religious journals in America, not known for its evangelical conviction, the Christian Century, commenting in an editorial upon the death of those five men, inferred that it was a foolish waste of life. But you see, they missed the point completely. Finally, we're not called to see how we can protect our life in the most comfortable, the most easygoing lifestyle. No, we're called to follow and to leave the consequences with God. One of those men who was martyred when he was in college years before had written in his journal, he is no fool who gives what he cannot keep to gain what he cannot lose. That's the way we look at it. And when God leads you, you can trust Him. He knows the way. And all along the journey, you're going to have fellowship one with another. And the blood of Jesus Christ will continually cleanse from sin, even as you continue to learn and make disciples. Living in the excitement of the Great Commission.